I've got brakes, I'm wide awake. I can stop this car at any time. At the very last second, I can change directions, turn completely around if I feel so inclined. I've got a mind that can steer me to your house, and a heart that can bring you red flowers. My intentions are good and earnest and true, but under my hood is internal combustion power. And Satan is my is my motor.
Noise in the background. Speaking of manifestations of incredible life, like you probably can't hear. It's probably too faint. But there's all these. I live in a town, and I'm kind of down into a valley, so I'm not immediately very close to a main street. But uh-huh. Right now,
I'm gonna put on my headphones.
Bozozoku's going by. You know, like do you guys know Bozozoku's? Like Godspeed You Black Emperor, like the sort of motorcycle gangs in Japan.
No.
Like the people, they get, it's like critical mass with motorcycles.
Oh, whoa.
They just take over the street, right?
Yeah, and I'm out here in the Bay Area right where now. Critical
and
mass is.
In the background. And it usually goes on for minutes, so there must be, like, I can't see anybody. Like, I'm too far away from the street, so I can't see how many, but usually there are, like, hundreds of them.
What town in Japan do you live in?
Where?
Yeah.
Don't say it, because I have to find that and edit it out.
Oh, okay, I'm sorry.
Tell them in Facebook chat.
Yeah. Sorry, like, no, I'm sorry. Yeah.
No, because I'm never gonna find this exact sentence somewhere. And
No. Like, it doesn't matter. It's close to Yokohama on the shore, basically.
Okay,
yeah.
Well, that's good. Well, we should talk offline because I'm gonna be in Japan next May. So.
Oh, really?
Yeah, my wife and I visited Japan in 2014 and had a transformative experience while we were there. And have been, and ever since then have been on a mission to move there.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Oh, yes.
It's a different story living here than just traveling. You know, it's like, I don't know, like some people really like it, some foreigners, but it depends. Yeah.
How long have you lived in Japan?
I don't know, almost a decade now.
Wow.
On and off, you know, like I go, I've been traveling a lot, so it doesn't seem that long, you know, but.
Well, we specifically decided when we were researching what we wanted to do, and our original plan was to try to experience the whole country, but what we ended up doing is staying in Tokyo for 2 weeks straight. And with the specific goal of, we wanted to immerse ourselves in the city, and so that the last few days we were there, we kind of felt we could get to the point where we knew the city well enough that we could kind of spontaneously just wander around and kind of just get this a taste of what it would be like to live there, and we succeeded in that, and ever since then we've never been the same since we got back. We had like postpartum Japan syndrome. I don't know what it was, but we've been dying to come back.
Yeah, my wife and I have went through the exact same thing.
Yeah, we've discussed this. Yeah, that's right.
I know. It was the postpartum, though, is the really accurate way to describe it. Like, I find it really hard to come back.
Yeah, well, especially when we our return flight had us stopping, had a like a 2 hour or 3 hour overlay in at LAX, and it was just kind of like the worst port to return to the States.
No, I still think I got you beat landing in Newark, New Jersey.
I don't know. We'll have to see. Well, maybe I'll see if I can reroute our return trip
the fucking
through
New- armpit of America. Yeah.
I don't know. Fresno, California, dude, could compete. But
yeah, it's yeah. There are problems here, of course. Like,
of course,
like everywhere, right? Like the government here has taken quite a bad turn.
Interesting.
And the plus side to that is that people are actually becoming active again, and even students who for decades were completely, basically apathetic, like not wanting to get involved in politics at all, and slowly they're getting back out on the streets and getting active again, which is kind of exciting to see.
Mm-hmm.
It's about this sort of militarization, a remilitarization.
Yeah,
that's an interesting development for sure.
Yeah, the reinterpretation of the Constitution so that it allows for collective self-defense,
right?
Which means that they can get involved in America's wars, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's self-defense, but we're fighting them over there, so we don't have to fight them here.
Yeah,
that's what we got.
Japan is bound by its constitution, which was sort of written up by the Americans after World War II, which has this clause in it called Article 9, which forbids the Japanese to use their military other than in self-defense, right?
Uh-huh.
This guy Abe, whose grandfather was also a prime minister, and before that he was a war criminal, right? And so he's kind of, Abe's following in his grandfather's footsteps, and the way that they're getting around that, they can't change the constitution because it's so hard to change. Like they need so much support all over the country to do it. So the way they're getting around that is just reinterpreting it. And so self-defense becomes collective self-defense.
Interesting.
So, yeah, it's kind of taking a dark turn. Like it's going to be interesting to see where it goes. It's a lot of most of the nuclear power plants are still offline after Fukushima. So they've just recently turned on a couple, but the fact that all of these power plants have been offline is meaning that these huge power companies are losing a lot of money to the point where they might eventually go under. And if they go under because of the kind of like incestuous relation that they have with the whole huge banking industry here, that the banks themselves are in danger, right? If that happens. So they have to prevent this from happening at all costs, right? And so it's a matter of what are they going to do, like how are they going to, I don't know. I don't want to think of things like false flags and stuff, but it would be I can't help but thinking that that's they must be considering something like that.
Levels,
right?
Or but when you say false flag, it's like, you know, again, I'm sort of giving the American example here when I said the we also got the quasi excuse, even though we're not we are actually constitutionally bound to declare war if we want to, but no one seems to remember that or give a shit about that. No one here seems to hold our constitution to any sort of standard. But regardless, the point I was trying to make is that we were also given the argument that it was a quasi reinterpretation of self-defense when George Bush would say we have to fight them over there so that we don't have to fight them here. We're still defending ourselves, but their, you know, we'll blow their shit up. rather
the Bush doctrine.
Exactly right. It's a self-defense war, but we're going to the best defense is a good offense, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So it's that sort of bullshit.
But, I think it's the same
yeah,
movement. Like that's
absolutely
basically.
Yeah. But as I said, like, when you talk about the sort of failing of the banks, and all that, what we had here was they used the expression "too big to fail."
Yes.
You know, and the huge bailouts, which is why, you know, when you consider, I have a sort of, how do I say this? Barack Obama, his first week in office, right? There were three things that man did his first week in office that to me proves beyond a shadow of fucking doubt that he's no different than George Bush. One of which was bombing Pakistan. So he first week in office, invades a new fucking country. He also issued an executive order to protect the phone companies. This was as part of the NSA spying, where people were outraged that George Bush was spying on everyone, and that the CIA and NSA were utilizing AT&T and all these companies to spy on American citizens. Well, Barack Obama, his first week in office, issues an executive order to make sure that, hey, those phone companies cannot receive any kind of repercussions from this. He's done a thing to protect them from legal damage for their illegal activities because they were part of our, government-sponsored illegality, if you will. And the third thing he did was trillions of dollars bailout to the mega banks. So proving he was completely in bed with the military-industrial complex and the financial interests. People call him a socialist. The whole like, oh, he's this Marxist, Islamic socialist, blah, blah, blah. No, he's a fucking crony capitalist. That's corporate socialism, not right? So my point is here, it didn't take a false flag for that. It was just, I think, when you talk about things of economics, it's so easy. We have this, the expression voodoo economics?
Yep, sure.
Well, I feel like those two things, like American economics is, by definition, sort of voodoo economics, the way it's utilized, is
right.
You have someone come on TV and say, listen, you don't understand. It's this really complicated thing that happens here, and, just trust us. It's oogie boogie. The boogeyman's coming for you, and the whole economy's going to go in the toilet unless we do this thing. And it's no different than military terrorism. ISIS is going to come, and Osama bin Laden's going to blow up your house if you don't let us bomb this country. It actually works even easier in the economic standpoint of your 401k is going to be in the garbage if you don't let us give trillions of dollars to, Wells Fargo or whatever it is. So,
I know what you're saying. Economics, it is all voodoo. Uzura, as Ezra Pound says, it's like it's just usury, right? It's just
exactly
creating money out of thin air and dishing it out as credit, right?
Yeah.
So the richest countries are those countries who have the best access to credit, right?
Right.
The thing here, so there's a problem with that as well here, okay? And which is that with Japan and the U.S. as trading partners, there's always this kind of like imbalance of trade, right? Where the Japanese would sell all this stuff to the Americans, and then they would get dollars in return. And then the Japanese government, instead of investing that money back into their own economy, they would buy U.S. Treasury bonds, and then basically buy U.S. debt, right? And so it was this whole sort of international mechanism for exporting U.S. inflation, right?
AKA money laundering, but yes.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So, but now because these nuclear power plants are shut down, Japan's having to import all this oil, right? And so they no longer have this sort of trade surplus. And so they no longer have such a dollar surplus. And so their support of the U.S. dollar is failing as well, right? And so that's part of the pressure that's coming through with Abe as well. You know, it's like this whole sort of economic house of cards or is all sort of tottering, you know, and they're really going to have to do something about it at some point, you know, like some, and of course the best way to sort of unify a country is an external enemy, right?
Yes.
Then that's
so. That's what I'm kind of worried about here. You know, it's like.
And maybe this is a no-brainer for you, but what we saw here was obviously with rising oil prices, it was very easy to there came a point under the Bush doctrine where you didn't even have to justify it. Actually, George Bush went on TV and said, "Don't worry, the oil that we get from Iraq will pay for the war." And then people are like, "Oh, okay, it's not going to cost me anything. Go kill all the brown people you want. If you're going to, I get to fill up my SUV cheaply, and you can go. I don't care. Go fuck ahead. Take their oil, rape their women. It doesn't matter." And I wonder, and to just give you this sort of scary notion, is if you guys are now in that oil dependency and economic crisis, and they want to be militaristic, that's a perfect excuse to say, "Hey, you know, we need all this oil and we can't keep buying it from America. We might have to go kill some of our own brown people and get it." You know?
Well, and then on top of that, it's like people have said this in the past a lot, is that Japan is not a nuclear weapons power, right? They're a nuclear power just because of the amount of nuclear power plants that they have. But that could change at literally a flip of the switch here. Like, the technology is there for Japan to go nuclear in all senses, basically overnight. Yeah.
Right.
And if there's an external enemy, right, like, say, like a North Korea,
yep.
And North Korea does have nukes, you know, it's like, if there's an incident that happens, then that's the perfect way to have an excuse to turn back on the power plants, let them go nuclear in both senses, and unify the country under this new nationalistic agenda, you know. So I might be projecting all of that, you know, but I really see that as being a danger here, you know. People here are so group-minded, so sort of conformist in a certain way. Nobody really wants to stick out, and even those people who do stick out tend to stick out in groups, right?
Right.
So it's
interesting.
Like, and when things change, when the public changes opinion, that happens really rapidly, and everybody changes, like a flock of birds all flying off at once, you know?
Yep.
But on the other hand, because of this opposition that's sort of percolating more and more, it could go that way as well, you know? It's like, it's kind of an interesting time. It worries me in a certain way, you know?
Yeah, it's
worrisome. I guess it's the... it's just a reflection of where the world is at, you know. It's like the only way that the global economy got out of the crisis that happened in 2008 is by creating a bailout bubble all over the place. And so the governments of the world took on the debts of the banks, and then because of that, there's all these austerity measures, and countries all along the line are falling out because of these things, you know? So it's like, how long are they going to be able to juggle those balls in the air, you know?
Right.
I don't know. It's just what's happening here in Japan is just, it's a symptom of something much bigger, you know? And then you have this kind of rise of fascism all over the place, rise of nationalism and rise of fascism, and even as we have found out in our own community, kind of, you know, our own sort of extended community here, you know.
And I assume that you're talking about the sort of right-wing movements of the Red Ice crowd.
Yeah, yeah. Which is, it's huge. Like, I just talked to a friend back in Canada, and I got him into Red Ice years ago, and I got him into, like, looking into conspiracies and stuff. And now I was talking to him about Red Ice, and I was like, oh, Red Ice has gone really kind of white power. And they were like, I don't think they've gone that way at all, you know. Like,
wow.
It made perfect sense, you know. I'm like, oh!
Oh, geez.
You know, but I hear that all over the place, you know. It's like,
yeah, and what the fuck is happening in Canada? Like, Canada is, I mean, from what I can gather, as again, it's not my country, and it's all secondhand news, but it certainly seems like they've taken on a really strict interpretation of that sort of, wow, let's be a bunch of racist imperial fucks.
Yeah, well, what's happened in Canada over the last decade, I guess, like the Conservative Party has been in power all that time, and the reason that's happened is because the vote on the left is split between two or three different parties, sometimes four different parties, and the Conservatives, because of the Canadian system, it's the first past the post system, right? And so in every riding, whoever gets the most votes, no matter how much of the population supports them, right? So they might have only like 20-25% of the actual vote from riding to riding, but if all the rest of it's split between a bunch of other parties, they still get the seats, and then they get the most seats in parliament and form the government. So it's like, the Canadian government is insane as well, you know? It's like,
yep.
You were just, how long had it been, if I don't want me to ask this publicly, let me know, but I know you were just back there recently. How long had it been since you were home? Or if you still think of it that way, I don't know.
Yeah, this time only 2 years. Like,
okay.
Then 2 years ago, it had been my first time since 5 years. You know, so yeah, I don't get back that often. So I've kind of missed this whole Harper stage, Harper regime in Canada over the last decade. But they're having an election soon this month, and people are really hoping that something's going to change.
It's amazing when you can go away from a place for not that long and it's suddenly unrecognizable. Like,
yeah, exactly.
I moved out of New York I lived there for 32 years. Like, you know, I was born and raised there. I moved out. I spent a year living in North Carolina. I went back to visit and it was like, boom, suddenly, you know, half the streets like were closed down for cars and they put in all of these like bike lanes and these I don't know what they're called, like pay per bicycle, like you can like basically rent a bike on any corner and then you ride it for however long you want and then you put it into that same the next thing on a few blocks away and it charges you for are you renting it for 20 mm-hmm. minutes or whatever, right? And it was still all these sort of, you know, measures to, I don't know, curb traffic or congestion or pollution or hey, everyone should bicycle, I don't, you know, whatever the idea is. But it's just suddenly like, whoa, why are there like enormous bike racks in the middle of the street on every block? Like, what the fuck is this? This is fucking crazy. And they're all covered in Citibank logos because guess what? It's sponsored by Citibank and they're the ones who are doing the whole payment program. And it's like, whoa, 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 whoa. Like, this is, you know, this is a total, I don't know, if, you know, for me, a corporate collaboration scheme, a kickback. This is insane. Anyway, so they're, you know, what are they getting off every transaction and the advertising and et cetera, et cetera. So I'm just like, this is fucking weird. And then I went away for another few months and I came back and suddenly it's now 25. I mean, these are not like fascist, you know, like right-wing governments. I'm just saying, like, when you can be like, whoa, I don't reckon. There's now a 25-mile-an-hour speed limit imposed across the entire city. There's no street that you can drive down and go more than 25 miles an hour. I'm like, wait, what?
Well,
that makes no fucking sense. And like my brother's like, yeah, that's what they did. Like, I'm like, wait. So I don't know. It's just bizarre. Like, how much in a short amount of time, fairly major. And again, my examples are much smaller, but it's like, you know, makes you wonder that whole like boiling frog idea of, you know, or like maybe you see this with like your child, where it's like, or like, you know, if you have like a sibling, like a niece or a nephew or something, where the ones that you're watching grow up seem to be growing slower, and then you could have like a niece or a nephew that you don't see in a year, and you're like, oh my god, you got so big, right?
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
So you're in the city or you're in the country and you're watching this slow moon. You're like, no, we're doing okay, you know. It's but then you like, you go away for a little bit and you're like, holy shit, what happened to you? You fucking right wing fascist pricks, and your economy's failing, and you're all fucking killing foreigners. What's happening here?
Yeah.
You grow up so fast.
Yeah, who knows? So I don't know. I see more and more my role in this blog or whatever is trying to fight fascism in a certain on a certain level. Like I don't know if I want to go like real direct level, but it's almost like getting into the gears of it and trying to tweak it and the gears of the so-called counterculture or whatever and tweak it so that it doesn't go in that direction. Like I just saw an InfoWars article, or it was a video actually, of the English guy who works with Alex Jones. I can't remember his name. Anyways, the guy...
I don't know.
He came up with this video clip saying it was entitled "Conservatism is the New Counterculture."
Interesting.
And his point was that the whole culture has become so liberal and so PC and so blah blah blah, the whole thing, right? So multicultural and all this, cultural Marxist or however you want to call it, like feminist, all of that, right? That now conservatives are the counterculturalists, right? Like they're the ones they're the only political group that's really going against the new world order, right? The actual
culture. It's like it's taking the modern, it's like it's literally taking your counterculture and turning it into a bunch of yuppies like they did last time.
Right. Not even that though, like he wouldn't say that these guys are yuppies because That was a matter of the yuppies of the counterculture selling out and becoming the mainstream culture, right? So he's saying that these conservatives are outside of the culture, like they're not. It's not yuppies who are really integrated into the culture, like steering the culture, basically. These conservatives in I don't know what, like rednecks or whoever, like Alex Jones fans or whoever, right? These guys are the true counterculture now, which I think there's some truth in it.
Yeah,
because
there is.
There are libertarian values there that I share, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Or anarchist values there that I share, but in the so-called left-wing counterculture, I see similar values, you know, libertarian values that I share as well, or anarchist values that I share as well. And so to me, it's not conservatism that's the counterculture, but there's sort of anti-authoritarian movements on all sides of the spectrum. I think that's what we sort of have to concentrate on getting together.
Yeah, it's the same thing as I was trying to say earlier about the the archetype that the Christ and the Antichrist is the same thing, right?
Right.
The conservative and liberal movements are the same thing, where the
yeah.
liberal movements are just as fascist, where it's like you have to believe in, you know, intellectual and religious authority of Neil Tyson Degrassi. You have to believe that, you know, third wave feminism is, you know, which is whatever, right? Like all the different things that you have
to
believe.
Just like you're saying, like bike racks sponsored by Citibank, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
But at the same time, you know, the conservative movement. See, like, you know, my wife and I make a joke where we say, like, Republicans are sort of like in your face with their ugly ideologies. It's like they're so easy to hate.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, but so, you know, it's like, you know, where there's like, I don't mention that as often because it's like, of course they're fucking fascist pricks. Do I really have to say that? So it's like, I was talking to Will Morgan the other night because I just did another synchronized video, and Andras and I got into a little debate as to like some of the content that I had in there. He said I was focusing too much on the political and, you know, sort of continuing to harp on this Obama idea, which he felt wasn't relevant to the thing.
Mm.
And I'm like, you know, I was like, yeah, I'm going to fucking harp on this. Like, yes, I'm going to fuck. And like, so I was talking to Will Morgan last night, and he was like, so are you saying, like, he was like, are you just like anti-liberal? And I'm like, no, what? Well, I was like, I'm trying to point out that this guy that everyone's like, Obama's fucking great because, oh, you know, he said it's okay for us to be gay. And it's like, it doesn't matter. He's a fucking homicidal maniac. Like, he said it's gay if you join you could join the army. Yeah, I don't care if you're gay. Go ahead, join my army. Go kill fucking people for me. Like,
yeah,
it's no
yeah.
fucking different than George Bush. I was like, my thing is not that I'm anti-liberal. It's like, if anything, I just want to say, I want everyone to stop what they're doing and be like, wait a second, there's no difference. There's
Thank
no
you.
Fucking difference.
Yeah,
like,
there isn't.
The Christ, you know, one guy says, this is my Christ and this is the Antichrist. I'm like, they're both fucking... They're again, you know, the heart of darkness or whatever you want to say. It's like they're just as fucking corrupt and evil and
yeah.
oppressive.
Different sides of the same coin, basically.
Yeah, and that's really all I want to fucking like.
I
you
hear
know, it's you. Easy to look at Donald Trump and be like, "Oh, he's a fucking ignorant prick," and it's like it's not so easy to have that. I still like. I'm going to say something. Here's like, you know, like take race into it. I can honestly say, this is the most fucked up thing, I cannot wait till we don't have a black president anymore, because
yeah.
then I can finally fucking say, hey, look, that guy's a fascist prick, and I don't have to be looked at like, oh, so you don't like Obama, because what, he's black? It's like, no, I'm just saying he's a fucking fascist, like, he's just like George Bush. Look, George Bush is a fascist. George Bush is
for
a fucking fascist.
For similar reasons,
he was
I
right.
don't like.
I said it about him. I'm just
yeah.
saying about this guy.
I want this
when this goes away, and then I can be like, hey, look, if they hope they fucking make Donald Trump president, so I can be like,
yeah, me too.
Hey, look, the president's a fucking fascist prick, and then everyone will go, yeah, I know, right?
Right.
Instead of being looked at like I'm fucking crazy.
That's so funny because I always kind of felt that, you know, the Obama presidency represented an opportunity to finally just, you know, say, hey, look, a black person's just as capable of being a total, you know, fascist asshole as a white person is. Like, equal opportunity, right? You know? I mean, it's... I don't know.
Yeah, that's why I...
Precisely.
The same reason why I don't want Hillary to get in, you know? Because then it will be you're against women if you're against the president. You know?
Right.
It's like, if you're against fascism, you're against women. You know?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't matter what gender or race or religion or whatever or economic class you come from. We all have the capacity to be a brutal dictator. You know?
Which, if you truly were living the liberal ideology, you would admit that you would look past their race or gender and
right.
just look at their actions.
Exactly.
Which is really what I'm arguing for. Is
exactly.
I don't care if he's a fucking black man or a fucking purple woman lesbian from Neptune. The point is that he's fucking bombing hospitals and fucking imprisoning American citizens, and that's wrong.
Yep.
That's it. End of
Period.
Fucking story.
End of story. It's not a race issue. It's a human issue.
that being said, there is a race issue here because, I mean, here's something, right? I've actually had this conversation with Republican conservatives. Every time someone's like, "Oh, Obama's trampling all over the fucking trampling over the Constitution," right? You know, fucking Marxist, whatever, blah blah blah, trampling over the Constitution. I'm like, hey, I'll tell you what. I'll here's something I would support. Why don't you start a movement to impeach Barack Obama for military action without congressional approval? The same thing that a bunch of Democrats tried to raise impeachment charges against George Bush for.
Yep.
Right? Why don't you do that? They won't do that. They don't. I have not had a single person say to me, "Hey, that's a good point. That's against the Constitution." Why? Because they don't fucking care that that's against the Constitution.
Right.
And they might want to do that. When the next Republican gets in, he might want to do the same thing.
Well, that's the thing. I mean,
a single fucking Republican care that that is against the fucking Constitution. I can't get any reaction out of it.
You're touching on, though, what I think has been the elephant in the room for many years now, and that is that it's this area that I feel like a lot of these public figures, whether they're political, whether they're cultural, whether they're coming from the scientific community or whatever, that nobody ever really wants to acknowledge. And that is, you know, the larger question, like, there, you know, for many years, it was very hot on, like, YouTube or whatever to see, like, Richard Dawkins debates creationist, or Neil deGrasse Tyson debates creationist, or this, some, you know, political person from the extreme left debate somebody from the extreme right. And it's like, there's clearly, like, neither side has any interest whatsoever in convincing the opposition to their argument, in bringing them to the other side, because nobody wants to really consider what would happen if one of those debates resulted in the opposition actually conceding, because the fallout that would occur within the communities that support either side would be insurmountable for that individual. It's like you take Richard Dawkins and what's his name, Ray Comfort, the guy, you know, with the whole banana theory about the whole Kirk Cameron. It's like, what would happen if what's his name, Ray Comfort, all suddenly comes out and says, "You know what? Richard Dawkins is right. I stand corrected, and now I've converted to flying spaghetti monster agnosticism or atheism." I mean, and what would that mean for that guy's entire, like, that's his entire revenue stream is continuing to portray this character that is
even crazier if Richard Dawkins went the other way.
Exactly. Doesn't matter. I mean, you flip the scenario
all over the place, having total existential crisis.
Yeah, I mean, that would be the end of his career.
To see, you know,
like, right, and nobody wants to talk about the fallout that would occur if actually one of these debates were a legitimate debate where the person on the losing side would concede and then come over to the other team. The fallout that would occur as a result of that, the media wouldn't know what to fucking make of that, and it would just be total chaos, you know? Cats and dogs sleeping together, total hysteria. And that's the thing, like, that nobody wants to acknowledge, you know, is like, what would actually happen if all of a sudden, you know, Bernie Sanders woke up and said, "You know what? George W. Bush had some good things to say, actually." You know, like, what the media would just go back to the Kardashians, you know? They wouldn't even want to talk about it anymore. Yeah. Because the theater would the suspension of disbelief required to participate in the theater that the media portrays every day, it would just break down, and the narrative that is so simplified as this kind of us versus them narrative, it would become more complex than this binary black and white, you know, what side of the issue are you on? And then suddenly the public would have to grapple with the complexities of reality, and it would be total fucking chaos.
Yeah, yeah. Like, yeah, exactly. Like, McLuhan even started to call it that, beyond the global village is the global theater.
Right? Exactly. And that was when he had already been written off as a quack when he was talking about that.
But that's exactly what it is, right? It's like,
it was like when Jon Stewart was on Crossfire. He's like, this is theater. You know, it's like he accuses he's like, you wear a bow tie and you're 35 years old. Like, you actually you expect me to believe that you're actually taking a stand. You're just, you know, satisfying the public's need for you to fit into this role so that they can sit there and validate themselves as saying, I'm on this side or I'm on that side. And I've done my duty as a citizen, which is really to just consume infotainment and then go to bed and get up and go back to work and just contribute to the complex of the media industrial complex. I just slap any term in front of industrial complex because that's all it is anymore.
No, I'm with you on that. And this is, you guys have brought this full circle, I think, back to what I really, like, Zenor, in your latest post, sort of zeroing in. Now, you know, obviously, McLuhan's got the, albeit a sort of Gnostic version of Catholicism, he does have his own religious biases.
Sure.
That being said, his point of saying media can just as easily be our destruction as it could be our savior is so relevant and so sort of under-recognized. Unless, of course, you want to go to the super sensational, like, conspiracy side of things. Like, Wally, you said before, why is Dali, recognized by everyone as being great? You know, you'd have like your Jan Ervin out there being like, that's because the CIA is promoting him as blah. You know, I was like, shut the fuck up. It's more complex than that. You know,
it's because he's tapped into some collective truth about the human experience, period.
Okay, collective truth. So this is again, just, and these are questions. We are saying, you know, you have your dichotomy, your sort of Hegelian dialectics that say you're either a conservative or a liberal. You know, it's this or that, and the truth lies in one of these two ideologies. Are you a Coke or a Pepsi? And we're all seem to be agreeing in to varying degrees that, well, the truth is much more complex than that, and there's lots of gray areas in between, and there's valid points on both sides, and things are just way more complex than right or wrong.
Yep.
But then when you say that you have tapping into a truth, I mean, this is a question, what is truth, right? Like, I think this is something where I do see criticism leveled against, like, taking relativism to its absolute extreme. Is at what point is there no right or wrong? Is there a point at which we would argue that there? And I'm not trying to ask you to define your ideology or your line in the sand. I'm sort of asking, just again as an intellectual exercise, is how would you? Where do you begin to draw those lines, or do you?
Well,
Who wants to go?
Go ahead.
Yeah, just to return also to that point, I think this goes to what we were saying before about like tastes in media, right? Like highbrow or lowbrow or whatever, right? Like,
yes.
And so I think, Wally, you mentioned before about like comparing Finnegan's Wake and who did you compare it with? Like
an episode of Friends.
And I've heard, I think, Alan, you talking to somebody, it could have been Doug or something, comparing it to comparing Finnegan's Wake with a Rihanna video, right?
And yeah, so, awesome.
so you have and I agree with what you said before, Wally, about like both of them have the truth in it. They have all of it in there, right?
Yes.
But if the difference is, this is how I sort of was visualizing it, is that you look at the Mandelbrot set, right?
Yes.
And you can see the whole pattern. When you zoom out, you start with you can see the whole Mandelbrot set, right?
Yes.
And then you zoom in, and it just, you find elaborate detail, which is really beautiful in itself, but you can't find the Mandelbrot itself again for quite a while until you zoom more and more and more into it, right?
Right.
And then eventually you come again, and there's the whole Mandelbrot again, right?
Right.
And so, but in every point, there's everything. Every point of that, even when you're going off on the obscure curlicues or whatever, the Mandelbrot is in there somewhere, right?
Yes.
But it's not visible. You don't see it. You don't apprehend it, right? And so I think something like the difference, like Finnegan's Wake, is you see the entire Mandelbrot. The Mandelbrot is obviously there. But in a Rihanna video or an episode of Friends or whatever, it's not as obvious. Yeah, you have to sort of dig into it more, and then wow, there it is. Okay, now
sure,
it,
came
again. You know, and so I think that's the same. So I don't know, like that. I think that also speaks to what Alan was saying about like relativity of in general. You know. It's like certain things are obvious, certain things are wholly there, you know, and then these other things you have to do more searching to find them, you know.
Yes. Well, I mean, the point I was going to raise is, you know, if I were cornered and confronted to articulate any form of absolute truth that can be articulated, it is this notion of absolute relativity, in that you know, well, I mean, I don't even know that it needs to be explained. I think it's just that it all comes down to, I like to borrow the basis of the book Guns, Germs, and Steel, which is what, you know, Jared Diamond does this tries to approach this notion of inequality from a scientific angle, and ultimately arrives at this profound hypothesis that it's geography that really, at the end of the day, kind of dictates this, just, you know, what resources are available to a particular culture, and it's a gamble. It's almost just this game of chance in terms of where.
Right. Right.
Where that culture happens to reside on the planet geographically. And I would say that when it comes to media, which is ultimately the only means human culture has to express their point of view, is through media. And once again, it comes down to your perspective, which is based in a very realistic sense on your geographical and temporal location, you know, depending on when and where you are, a symbol set carries with it a certain set of meanings that is ephemeral, maybe ephemeral, not necessarily ephemeral, or a perceivable ephemerality within your lifetime, but on a long enough timeline, it is fleeting. This context in which you place your symbol set, right? But because that symbol set is going to transcend your time and place and arrive in another time, in another location, and take on a whole new set of meanings. And as time passes, you know, and now that we have things like the internet that allow us to kind of view how all of those media have transcended time and space and transformed and taken on and glommed on all of these new meanings and obsolesced other meanings and retrieved older meanings and et cetera. Now it's just this this almost impenetrable amalgam of you know, accumulated meaning that is changing at a pace that we can't even really keep track of. At the end of the day, it's all relative to where and when you happen to be, and how you choose to interpret a particular symbol set in that moment in time, and that informs everything, every choice that you make from that point on and before. I mean, it's almost transcends the idea of time. It's just, so to me, the only ultimate truth is absolute relativity.
Yeah. Like, even, like, I've heard that as a critique against McLuhan, right?
Uh-huh.
So McLuhan is saying that basically our media determines everything, determines the environment, determines the culture, determines our psychology, everything. Right?
Yes.
But then it's like, well, where did print come from? There was a, there are all these factors involved in the creation of print, right? So there's something sort of behind that, which may eventually lead to geography, like you were saying. But then even that, it's like there are reasons that those people are living in that particular place at that particular time, right?
And, yes.
And so it even goes further back. There's no end to it, you know?
I would say that it's economic. I mean, there's a basis in it that's economic, I think, that is there, you know.
Well, except that even our nature of economics has changed, right?
Like, well, sure.
So if you have a gift economy, right, based on the thinking that the original gifts were given from the gods, right?
Okay.
Then your economy, your whole economics becomes religious, right? And so then you can trace it further back and say, yeah, well, maybe it's religious, right? It's religious determinism that and then. But
well,
even
I think
bad,
that,
then,
but I guess my point about it being economic maybe is if to reduce it even further, it's this. If you were to break it down in a kind of Claude Shannon kind of approach, where it's a simple model, the simple Shannon model of a message needing to be transmitted of some kind or some you know, there is a necessity that is born out of a scarcity of the a current media, and the scarcity of there's a scarcity of scribes. Right, there's a scarcity of parchment, there's a scarcity of ink, and therefore there is this necessity. I mean, the mother of invention is, speaking of Zappa, is necessity. And so print is born out of this necessity for a larger demand for the written word to be disseminated. And so it's inevitable that someone comes along and invents a new medium that addresses that scarcity and solves a problem, which is, you know, we have a higher demand for people wanting to be able to transmit messages, and therefore the printing press is born to address a need.
But then it only becomes a need or becomes popularized after, like, for example, Luther's Reformation, right? Like,
yes.
Basically, he's saying that we can now use the German vernacular as our language of revelation,
right?
And we don't need the Latin Church anymore.
Well, it's
right?
interesting
so
too
it's like,
that like, and you touched on this before, and about how print creates this standardization, and McLuhan
right.
was one of the first to come along and say that the printed word gave birth to nationalism. Because,
exactly.
You know, and this is what almost created this sense of national unity, is the standardization of the language.
Yeah, I was just talking about this in terms of Japanese history last night, and it's like the feudal period in Japan lasted until the 1860s, right?
Right.
And then you have this massive movement, the Meiji Restoration, that basically created the whole nationalist myth of Japan in just a few short decades, you know? It's
yes.
Like, before that, there was no sense of Japan, you know, as a nation. There was all these warring factions, like it's basic feudalism. Like people were loyal to their daimyos, and that's it, you know?
Mm-hmm. And wasn't
so,
there,
yeah, and that's happened in every so-called modern country.
Yeah,
like in France, to create the French language, you had to kick out the Franco-German Germanic speakers and all these different dialects
right.
and variations of
right.
of French and then Spanish and then all these things, and then you create this French language. And then you create a French dictionary with grammar and proper spelling, and you know, it's like,
yep.
Well, that was your point before, right, about the idea of the what are the, like, basically the language is the the language is what oppression sounds like, which, you know, is even almost like, you know, like when you have like this sort of, this is what democracy looks like, or this is what oppression, it's like, this is what oppression sounds like.
Absolutely. And what are the words that are born out of an oppressed culture that that are used to express, well, I mean, like I was saying before, if you look at the words in certain cultures that at some point in their history experienced extreme oppression from another culture, you look at the words in that oppressed culture that represent, you know, secrecy, or represent words that about, or words for oppression even, or the mm-hmm. word oppression, or the word this is hidden knowledge, or this is or something has been stolen, or something has been threatened, or something has been killed, or something has been usurped, or you know, all of the, you look at you know, the history of, or the etymology of these types of words in language, and going back to Guns, Germs, and Steel, like, what are the geographic factors of a certain culture, and what are the evolutionary advantages of that culture, and why they chose to put together certain phonemes and certain morphemes into words that are used to preserve aspects of the culture that were under threat by the oppressor, you know? And that's why my favorite website in the world is Wiktionary, which is an amazing lens through which you can very quickly analyze these tendencies throughout various cultures, because it shows you, you know, one collection of of a word, which is really just, you know, several phonemes glommed together to an assigned meaning. You trace it all the way back to the Proto-Indo-European, and you look at certain phonemes, and you also consider just what are the types of physical impedances that would have been placed on the actual people uttering these words, and like what words are going to survive when the people who are really in positions to preserve their culture have guns in their mouths, or have, you know, and they can only speak in vowels, or what are the words that are going to not survive because you need your tongue to utter them, and the people who are in positions to preserve their culture have had their tongues cut out, you know, and you find some very disturbing patterns in terms of the phonemes that are being put together to form some of these words, and you know, what are the basic sounds that can be made after all of your fucking teeth have been knocked out, you know?
Well, you would love this book. It's called Joyce's Book of the Dark by John Bishop.
Ooh.
And he gets into all of what you're saying, like in a really, really...
Wow, I'm totally writing this down.
but he traces all these, exactly what you're saying about these Proto-Indo-European roots, yeah?
Yes.
Oh, here, this is great. R is the one he meant. He has this whole sort of family tree mapped of it.
Like Oh my god.
So here's this root R, and then it gets traced to re and or and R.
Yep.
And then it eventually becomes real and reality, realist, realism,
yep.
Realty, republic, rebus, read, ritual,
and
rate, rational, reason, rectify, ratify, order.
Yep.
Ordinary, ordinance, primordial, ornament, art, artistic,
earth,
articulate, aristocrat, harmony, arms,
yep.
Army, disarm, alarm.
Army, yep. So it's Joyce's Book of the Dark?
Yeah, by John Bishop. It's really an intense book.
I'm totally going to check this out. This is so up my alley.
Really, it's hard to read, you know, because it goes so deeply into Finnegan's Wake.
Yeah.
But you would love these parts on the.
Yeah, that sounds great.
These etymological charts that he provides.
Before I forget, I've been meaning to. I want to share this with you guys both. I think I might have given this to you before, Alan. But one of the things that I stumbled upon that totally has informed a lot of my own thinking about this is this random article I found that was written in the like 1850s in a Christian Science journal for Quakers or something like that, and it's this really boring article, but what it basically gets at is this guy, the name of the article is Origins of Ancient Names of cities, countries, and like natural landmarks. And he
oh great
oh man it's incredible. But basically what he does is he posits that where is it? I downloaded it, damn it. Oh, here we go. Origins of Ancient Names. He basically says that every in let's see, there here it comes. Basically in Egypt, in Greece, Italy, in the ancient civilizations of Greece, Italy, Asia Minor, Babylon, Egypt, Phoenicia, and Judea, all names originate from the names of those cultures' sun gods.
And yeah, exactly. Yeah. So it all comes from the gods.
Yep. And it's eight phonemes. And it's ab, ak, am, ar, as, at, el, and on. And he goes.
These are the ones that he mentions.
Yep. I just shared it with you guys in the chat window. So check that out and see what you guys think.
Here's the quote that he provides from Finnegan's Wake, talking about the Rs. Just because we mentioned that.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
So here it is. Those Rs. Those Rs, all bellical. The high priest's hieroglyph, rasted red-handedly from our hallowed rubric prayer for truce with booty, and rudely from the fane pinnacle tossed down among those who arse without the temple.
Wow. But
that's everything we were talking about.
That's
pirates,
everything.
Bellicose, Mars. Wow.
Yeah, dude. Here, I should... let's see if I can share this. Yes, I sure can. Copy image. Can I do this? Yeah. Okay, so this is in the... if you see in your chat, this is the very first page of the liner notes of my band's first album that has the capital R in the name. I made this. You see this?
Just a second. There's a bunch of runes there. I'm having a problem blowing this up somehow. Oh, here we go. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, so it looks like your standard like first page of out of the volume of the encyclopedia for the R, but it goes into some, it gets progressively weirder and weirder.
Resh. Huh. Row, yeah. That's a huge one too.
So like the last like six or seven facts here are totally made up. Not made up, but just not necessarily from your average encyclopedia.
Pirates were the first masters of the earth and leader of secret societies. Pirates habitually use R as an interjection. Have you ever read Peter Lamborn Wilson on Pirate Utopias?
Oh, no, I haven't read about that. I got all of my pirate stuff from Buckminster Fuller. He has a whole chapter in his book, Operating Manual for Spaceship Earth, about how his theory that, you know, pirates were the first kind of comprehensive thinking masters of the universe.
Well, yeah.
But, so this, you know, I used to put all of
pirates being the most worldly people there were.
Quite literally.
Right. They traveled, and now, you know.
And they also had, they had cutting edge technology for their time for, you know, basically for traversing the oceans, and they understood longitudinal and latitudinal coordinate systems, and I mean they really had, had the first iPhone.
What Peter Lamborn Wilson is talking about, I think he gets some of this information from Burroughs as well, who is interested in the subject, is that pirates created this whole kind of like international web work of autonomous zones, right?
Yes.
And in these autonomous zones, it was basically full on multicultural, multiracial democracy.
They probably established the first lingua franca too.
More authoritarian groups of pirates, but a lot of them were like that. You know, it's like so pirate utopias, right?
Totally.
Interesting.
Yeah, no, and they operated also with, you know, lingua franca, I guess is the term. which mm-hmm. was, you know, the language that would be, or languages of commerce that, like, in all of these ports of commerce throughout the world, the lingua franca was the language that everyone could understand in order to transact, right? And
sure.
I've always found it interesting that the word franca in that phrase is what it, you know, is what denoted it as this kind of universalist or free language, and franca and franco and being, you know, obviously
Frank,
yeah, Frank French. Or France and French
yeah.
and FR and freedom and you
and
know.
Franc being a unit of monetary
yes.
value.
It also used to mean postage, like
Frank
a
Zappa.
Stamp and Frank Zappa. And to be very frank is to be very outspoken and speak the truth.
Right.
You know, that's to me has always been a pretty loaded word that goes way back into you know, European history, especially conspiratorial history with Merovingian bloodlines and all of that stuff. But I don't necessarily have any like all-encompassing theory that ties it all together very succinctly, but there's something there.
I have pretty much got to go.
Yeah, I have to get going too, and this has been going for like 3 hours, but I got to say, I have a feeling this is going to be one of. This has just been an extraordinary discussion. I mean, I'm like, my brain is racing after
yeah,
all of
did,
this.
It, yeah, it's been excellent.
Are you
going to use this for a show, Wally, or how is this going to?
I think
go?
Alan was going to turn this into an episode of R.
That's Row, yeah, the show AR.
There you go.
Yeah, I think especially with 3 hours of content, I think the, I mean, you know, I think it's just if unless there's anything in there, I probably would cut out at the very very beginning. I don't know if there was just some talk about like conversations with Bob Dobbs. I don't know if that would be, you know, apparently Bob Dobbs is now listening. So I don't know if that's.
Oh, he's quite pleased. I think that we're talking about him. So
cool. Okay.
Yeah. I think he's happy that. It's sort of a new generation of people are sort of
yeah.
looking into his work. You know,
he had zero qualms about the fact that I shared our private communique in an episode of.
Right.
He was like, "Yeah, bring it on." So, I think he's all for it. Hey, Bob.
Yeah. Looking forward to talking to you.
I'm sure he's enjoying it immensely.
He's been on Skype this time, you know? It's like he's on right now on Skype.
Hey, man.
Actually,
just bring...
Bob is on.
But... He's always there.
Yeah.
Well, but yeah, I think we should...
Are you going to chop this up into multiple parts?
Yeah, probably. So my recorder cut out around 2.5 hours in.
Okay.
And then I picked it. So I lost just a few minutes in there.
Well, I've been going for 3 hours and 15 minutes here. If you want, you can send me your files and I can synchronize everything into a nice kind of stereo, you know, build or whatever of the whole talk, and then just maybe chop
it
up into like,
send it back to me as a thing to chop up.
Well, I'll sync it all up, and I can go ahead and edit it maybe into like 3 1-hour parts. You want to do that?
Sure. I guess
it's no trouble.
But
it's up to you. Whatever you want to do.
Yeah. No. So I guess the only thing I would ask is, so there's two different. This is, you know, this is actually a weird conversation, but it sort of gets to the point of, I feel like each show that we do has a different sort of, the medium is the message, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, in a very literal sense, each show sort of has its, for lack of a better term, sort of, role to play in its format. So, in that sense, unless there was something that you guys specifically didn't want out there, and that's what I was going to say, is if you want to make chop the beginning off or something like that, you know, basically the Always Record ethos has been
uncut.
It's all there mm-hmm. for people to, and I know, Bobby, we'd done one or two things before where you had made the offer and did some chopping, and I'm sure a lot of listeners appreciated that it's shorter to a certain extent, and I appreciate the effort, but I have to admit some hesitancy towards that, only because...
Oh, I was only suggesting to just chop it up into shorter chunks, but not necessarily removing anything.
Cool, okay. Well, that's what I was going to say. See, like, I would totally appreciate...
Yeah, it's no trouble. I mean, if I got to bring it in and sync it all up, it's only a few more steps to chop it into smaller chunks.
Right.
Yeah, I don't think there's anything that I've said that I want to be cut out of this conversation.
Yeah, me neither.
Cool. Yeah, I thought this was fucking fantastic.
It was really great.
Yeah,
I'm not going to be able to sleep now. I'm going to go find this John Bishop book and read it in one sitting.
Yeah. Well, it's a dense one, man.
Yeah.
It's going to be hard. There's a guy, what's his name? What's his blog? I should know this. There's a guy who did a sort of analysis or a book review, a really extensive book review. His name is, his website is just Finnegan's, Wake with exclamation mark. You can find a link to his site on my blog.
Okay.
But,
I hope everyone listening has already gone, but group name for grapejuice.blogspot.com. It's incredible.
Oh, yes.
I will link to it in the show notes, but I get the we've been looking at our statistics, and I get the impression there's a lot of people that are listening are coming to it from either, you know, like iTunes downloads or Stitcher, whereas on the website is reflecting. So I don't know how many people are actually seeing the links that I put up. So I hope that's another good example. I hope everyone knows thesyncbook.com. I'm constantly saying, but we will put referenced links and stuff like that always in the show notes.
Yeah. One thing that might be, I know you got to go, Znor, but one thing that might be interesting is to just record a little, like, kind of like on standard radio shows where they always pause and do a little show ID, or if you're just joining us, you're listening to so-and-so, we could insert a couple of little just kind of, you know, public service announcements where we maybe list a few links and...
I have a few, I had more and I actually lost them in a...
I could fire out a few new ones.
But I had, like, cool things where I had, like, I have Jake Kotze and, like, Jason Horsley and, like, Steve Wilner and things like that saying, like, you're listening to... This is Jason Horsley and you're listening to Sync Book Radio.
Mm-hmm.
Jason Horsley did that?
Uh-huh, he did that.
That's pretty...
I know. Yeah, he's a nice fucking guy. You know,
I like him a lot.
Oh, yeah. I know, it's surprising. I asked him if he would, and he was like, and then he did two readings of it, and he's like, actually, this is kind of fun. And I was like, okay, cool.
Nice.
I think he appreciated being asked. I don't know but I've never used it because I think he would be really particular about his voice, like, endorsing something, you know? So
sure.
Like,
yeah, that's what surprised
me. Exactly. Just like, I appreciate that he did it, but I've never used it for that reason.
Awesome.
I have some cool things like that, so.
I just find it so amazing that there are so many interesting people out there now.
Yeah.
You know, that to, like, you guys and then the wider community, it's just mind blowing, you know. It's like like how is this happening?
It's great.
Yeah,
it doesn't seem like it's, you know, it's like when I think every few months I'm introduced to somebody else that I'm like, holy shit, this guy is just this huge, amazing collection of information. you know, and I've felt that about both of you upon meeting each of you separately. And it's like, and there's countless others that it's like every few months I'm meeting somebody else and I'm like, holy shit, look at this person and look what they do. And wow, yeah. This is blah, blah, blah.
And they're all gravitating to you, Alan.
No, I know.
No, I mean it in all sincerity, actually.
I don't mean that at all. I mean, like, each of us on our own, I'm sure, are discovering different people. Zenora, you're finding, you know, like, you just mentioned this other guy who's got this website. And, you know, Wally, you've got your circle of people that you're into. So I feel like everyone has their own circle of things that they're being exposed to. And the great thing is that if we are continuing to have our minds blown and continuing to be impressed, then hopefully that means we're constantly learning and growing.
Absolutely.
So. Well, there seems that it's like on the brink of something, like a brink of some sort of renaissance almost. You know, it's like that is not fear-based. Like,
yeah.
Whereas over the last decade or more, well, since 2001, I guess, like this whole sort of fear-based counterculture, if you want to call it that. But I think we're right on the cusp of getting out of it. You know, it's like in a big way, and it's kind of exciting to see where that's gonna lead. You know.
Yeah. In my first email exchange with Eric McLuhan, he referenced his own thoughts that we're in the middle of a new renaissance, which I found exciting to hear from someone like him. So I couldn't agree
more. Obviously, it's a totally dark period in another way, but that's how it would happen, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, something else, McKenna, which, you know, I mentioned him a few times. I mean, I have immense respect for his intellect, and something he said is, we was talking about, like, you know, if we were to have any kind of advancement or radical change, he's like, you know, there's the conspiratorial, like, you know, what is it, Project for New American Century. Like, what we need is a new Pearl Harbor, a catalyzing event, right? Well, there's that, but McKenna makes the point. He's like, of course it would happen like that. He's like, you don't take to – he's like, if mankind is going to take to the stars, like, it's probably going to happen because they're running into spaceships to – flee some disaster, you know. He's like, that would finally get them off their asses to devote their resources to getting off the planet. Otherwise, it's a slow burn of like, okay, we'll send a satellite up. Okay, you know, we'll have another little mission here. He's like, in the catastrophe, humankind would take to the stars. Mm-hmm. That would be, you know, a lot of times it's the pressure that turns the coal to a diamond, or at least makes the drastic leap from one thing to another.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
On that note.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have a wonderful evening, gentlemen. Thank you all so much.
Yeah, thank you. It was great.
Thank you for satisfying my bro crush.
I was just gonna say, yeah.
Oh, man, I'm almost done with my open letter to Alec Baldwin that I'm going to tweet to him.
that'd be excellent to hear.
Yeah.
Yeah, when you said, oh, don't judge me for my bro crush on Alec Baldwin, I was going to say, like, well, I think it's totally okay. There's no judgment here, because I think there's a lot of that going on. I think there's immense respect and affection for both of you coming from me, and, you know, that's respect. That's everything. So,
right on.
Yeah, mutual.
Likewise.
All right, guys. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Good night. See you guys.
All right. Take care. Bye.
Hey, baby, what you know good? I'm just getting back, but you knew I would. War is hell. When will it end? When will people start getting together again? Are things really getting better, like the newspapers said? What else is new, my friend, besides what I read? Can't find no work, can't find no job, my friend. Money is tighter than it's ever been. Say, man, I just don't understand what's going on across this land. Oh,
what's happening, brother?
Yeah.
What's happening? What's happening, my man? Are they still getting down where we used to go and dance? Will our ball club win the pennant? Do you think they have a chance? And tell me, friend, how in the world have you been? Tell me what's up. I wanna know what's in. What's the deal, man? What's happening? What's happening, brother? What's happening? What's happening, brother? Say, man. Woo! What's happening, brother? What's been shaking up and down the line? I know, 'cause I'm slightly behind the time.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from Syncbook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune into our other Syncbook Radio programs, including 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leeds Mathmagical Radio Hour, Pentimental, Synchronize, Sync Quick News, as well as our most recent editions, Fine Just Fine and Hypnosis. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.